was doubtful if such a succession would really strengthen the government. The success is dependent simply upon the will of the consul, were unknown to the nation, had rendered her no service. The people would only consent to it through devotion to Napoleon. In a royal family which has reigned for several centuries, the princes of the blood are capable of succeeding to the throne by the very fact of their legitimate conception and acknowledged birth. Such a right of possession is rendered so sacred by time that it is called divine and is even believed to be so by some people. It is independent of the will of either the princes or the sovereign, who cannot, in a monarchically constituted state, alter the order of succession or set aside the lawful successors, however distant they may be, in favor of his own children, who are not the offspring of a legal marriage contracted with a princess of a royal house. This was the strict French doctrine. Even a woman was capable, whoever her husband might be, provided he was a prince, of transmitting to her children, whom she was supposed to have conceived by him, the right of succession which she had inherited from her father or mother, and which she exercised in person without the control of her husband. This indeed produced some surprising dynasties, but nevertheless at least four European monarchies were regulated by such laws. But a monarchical institution in which, from the foundation of the dynasty, the right of succession should be extended to the collaterals of the fortunate soldier who had established it was unexampled. This was to suppose an earlier right actually possessed by the father of the founder. In this case, Charles de Bonaparte would have been the entirely unconscious possessor of the right. Besides, Joseph and Louis would then share in the succession. But Napoleon, being a younger son, had no right to succeed to the detriment of his other brothers. A collateral succession is only justifiable by a common parentage, by the presupposed partition of the fortune of the common parent among his descendants, and the reversibility of these portions from one to the other. Here it was absurd, but all the ridiculous pretensions of Bonaparte's mother, brothers, and sisters were derived from it. In politics, anything is a handle. To admit a doubt is to awake a claim. To imagine a right is to create it. The problem of government by hereditary succession was not solved. It was only presented to the country under terms which would have been unacceptable if they had been taken seriously. They were agreed to only because they pleased Napoleon, and because its realization was deemed wholly unlikely. Moreover, Napoleon had reserved to himself a more rational solution by the power to adopt him whom he intended should he be recognized as his successor. But in reality, if not by law, this power was limited, for he could scarcely exercise it except in favor of one of his nephews. Again, only one of his brothers had male children, and would this brother consent to the adoption of his son? Would he give up to him the rights which he believed belonged to himself? Thus, the power of adoption only raised further difficulties and cast a new element of disturbance into the relations between Napoleon and his successors. A hypocritical fiction was suggested, perhaps by himself, to extricate himself from his difficulties. By this, though the rights which he had seemingly granted to his brothers were fully recognized, they were limited, or appeared to be limited, to their descendants. This fiction, if acted on, was likely to prove fruitful of dispute in the future. Owing to circumstances which Napoleon could neither control nor remedy, the Fourth Dynasty was established in a manner extraordinary and precarious. The founder was desirous of making stable the institution set up by himself with the consent of the nation. This was to be done by establishing a hereditary government. Here, there were, however, no direct lawful heirs in whom the nation might expect to find the peculiar virtues which had caused them to choose Napoleon for their chief. The succession devolved upon inferior personages whose only qualification was their relationship to the founder. Even so, it was not firmly established, for it could be altered at any moment by the simple desire of the founder. But since the order of succession was not invariable, the government was not strictly hereditary, and the agitation was in vain. Yet the imperial house was being founded to all appearances upon the model of the former royal house. At least Napoleon seemed to be biased in that direction. He appeared ready to follow the ancient lines, only substituting the Napoleons for the Bourbons. Thus, before 1789, the house of France had been chiefly represented by three princes of the blood, Louis XVI, the Count of Provence, and the Count d'Artois. In the same way, the house of France would now be represented by three princes, Napoleon, Joseph and Louis. Nor did Napoleon stop only at the revival of the traditions of the monarchy for the adornment of his dynastic pretensions. He bestowed on his brothers certain dignities which had always been reserved for the brothers of the king. For instance, the Count of Provence had been colonel of the Carbineers in succession to the Duke of Maine and the Duke de Dom. Accordingly, Louis was to be their colonel-in-chief, and he alone of the colonels-in-chief appointed at that time was to command the brigade which had been expressly summoned to Paris. Again, my Lord Count of Provence had possession of the Luxembourg, and Joseph was to live in the little Luxembourg, although, according to the terms of the Constitution, the palace with all its dependencies formed part of the endowment of the Senate. Such examples might be multiplied. This mummery, though perhaps he flattered himself to the contrary, was little likely to influence any but the stupid and ignorant. There is one certain proof, however, of his intention to substitute his own house for the Bourbons. This was the negotiations admittedly open for the purpose of inducing the Count of Provence to renounce his hereditary rights. This was a strange blunder on the part of such a man as Napoleon. By it, he furnished the pretender and the princes of his blood with an opportunity for a vigorous protestation and a striking argument against the legitimacy of the empire which he was constructing. Yet it was a well-intended blunder on his part. He was the incontestable possessor of the actual sovereignty, and it showed his wish to conciliate the most discordant parties, to remove all causes of strife between citizens, and by making a settlement on the French branch of the House of Bourbon, to discharge his own and the nation's debt to it. Certainly, he admitted that the Bourbons actually had a right by proposing to them that they should renounce it. It was difficult for him to reconcile such a right with the popular authority which had endowed him with the consular power. It was probable that he had little belief in that right in spite of his acknowledgement of it, but that he thought that his power would be more complete if the throne were surrendered voluntarily, and if, like the founder of the second dynasty, he could establish his family upon the ruins of the willing and unopposing House of Capet. On the failure of the negotiations, he denied having had any knowledge of them. It was said that the misdirected zeal of some inferior official alone could have called forth the letter of the pretender, in which he disclosed the proposals that had been made to him. Was it possible, Napoleon said later, that I, who held my power by the very authority, that of the sovereign people which excluded them, would seek to obtain the renunciation of rights which they had justly forfeited? It was easy to say this in St. Helena when he was endeavoring to prove that he had sought for no other source or consecration for his imperial dignity. But did he believe it in January 1803? Apparently not. For although he did not propose the matter to himself, to the Prussian ambassador Talleyrand, his foreign minister did. Monsieur de Talleyrand, wrote Lucchesini to his court on the 3rd of January, has observed that he intends to speak to me about a matter which for some time will be known in France only to him, myself, and the first consul. General Bonaparte has determined that the king, our master, alone shall hear of it because of the consideration and esteem felt for his wisdom, uprightness, and power. It was necessary for the king of Prussia to consult his ally, the emperor of Russia, on this important business, and he actually did so. But Napoleon declared that he had never directly or indirectly suggested such a thing in any way. Then it must be supposed that Talleyrand had taken upon himself, without speaking to the first consul, to make overtures to Lucchesini in his name, to open negotiations with the pretender, to involve two of the most powerful sovereigns of Europe, and to leave the consul open to a check grave enough to call for special declarations from Napoleon, and that for this political crime and abuse of confidence he went entirely unpunished. The thing is just not impossible, though highly improbable in anyone except Talleyrand.